The genre of post-apocalyptic fiction has been around since, I think the mid-19th century. Mary Shelley and H.G. Wells were a couple of the field's earliest authors. And on the radio, of course, the aforementioned H.G. Wells' War of the Worlds was a sensation in the hands of Orson Welles, no relation. But that term, post-apocalyptic, refers to that genre of fiction concerned about some sort of collapse of civilization, often related to out-of-control technology or some pandemic or some invasion of aliens or some such thing. And it's a field that's only grown in popularity over the last half century or so. I think my introduction to the field was when I read John Wyndham's book, novel, Day of the Triffids. And I remember watching, this is back in the 1960s, the movie Failsafe. Another one I remember was, of course, Planet of the Apes, post-apocalyptic fiction. Today, that genre is in full bloom. Post-apocalyptic TV shows and movies abound. And you can say that Mad Max has now actually become mainstream. Though I confess that I have become less enamored with these stories. When it seems like, you know, the world as I know it really does seem to be ending, well, watching a TV show about it just isn't quite as much fun as it was earlier on in my life. And I'll try and unpack that a little now. Our scripture reading, which is arguably the most discussed chapter in all of Mark's gospel, is sometimes referred to by scholars as Mark's little apocalypse. And that word apocalypse is derived from a Greek word, apokalypsis, which means quite literally an uncovering. See, I challenge you to try and work that into your everyday speech this week. Here, I'll just apokalypsis the bed. Okay, maybe it's a reach, but it's kind of a neat word. Rolls off the tongue. So, apocalypse, revealing or uncovering something, revealing something that was previously hidden from sight. Another way we would put that is a revelation, right? The book of Revelation, right there at the end of the New Testament, is indeed an apocalypse. And that's why it's sometimes referred to quite appropriately as the apocalypse of St. John. From that word, we also get the expression apocalypticism. And that's a bit different in that it refers to the belief that the end of the world is coming very close. And so that's where we hear the cry, the end is near. Now, to be fair, referring to our gospel today as an apocalypse is not technically wholly accurate. There are none of the expected visions or date setting that typically accompany a biblical apocalyptic passage. But there is no doubt that there is some kind of drawing back of the curtain going on in this text. Something is being uncovered. Something earth-shaking is being prophesied. Now, today's reading is located near the end of Jesus' earthly ministry. And two chapters before today's text, we learn that he and his disciples are in Jerusalem, which is the largest city, the capital, and the spiritual heart of Israel. And if you're in Jerusalem, well, there are some sites that are just must-see. For example, if you go to Coombs for the very first time, where do you go? You go to the market, right? You go to ponder the strangeness of goats eating on the roof. You go to Vancouver for the first time, odds are Stanley Park is going to be on your list somewhere, right? On your first trip to New York City, got to go up the Empire State Building. First trip to Rome, you got to see the Basilica, St. Peter's Basilica. You come here to Qualicum Beach for the first time, you shop at QF, right? You know? Not quite the same. Actually, I'm starting to think that a trip to Qualicum Beach, that what we should do is now behold the new and impressively large Berwick Place. Yeah, I did that at the early service too. Yeah, so. I'm probably going to have to think this through a bit more. I'll be back to you on that. Anyway, but in the first century, If you were visiting Jerusalem, particularly on your first trip, like you definitely went to the temple. And even though it wasn't quite finished in Jesus' day, it was staggeringly striking. For a start, it was really, really big. And it was this shining white, bright white. It was ornate. It had all this gold trim all over the place. It was awe-inspiring and breathtakingly beautiful. And even their Roman conquerors, I mean, they had some impressive architecture back home. They would also readily concede that it was remarkable. Indeed, the temple was a point of great pride for the people of Israel. So it's not really surprising that Jesus and his country bumpkin friends from Galilee would indeed tour the place, because that's just like what you did. Jesus and the crew, they visit the temple, and he finds himself having some rather lively conversations with the religious authorities. They become arguments. And traps abound for this controversial preacher from the sticks. And as Diane ably described last week in her sermon on the widow's offering, through observation of the temple life, Jesus was able to offer critical teachings to his disciples. But this morning, they're actually coming out of the temple. And one of his followers says something to the effect of, hey, can you believe this place? It's absolutely amazing, Jesus. I mean, the buildings, they're just huge. Heck, even the stones they use to make the buildings, they're massive. And in my mind, Jesus nods. And then he says, well, sadly, forcefully, thoughtfully, I don't know. But he points back at the temple and he says, see those buildings? Yeah, all of it's going to be rubble. It's all going to be thrown down. Ooh, now that's a bit of a downer. And not quite what his friends were expecting, surely, having just completed the grand tour. So the group move, I suspect in silence, to the Mount of Olives, which is just outside the walls of Jerusalem. And they are now looking across the city to the north, where they can see the temple in all its splendor. And some of the disciples, Peter, James, and John, those are the three kind of insiders, this time they are joined by the disciple Andrew. And they take Jesus aside, and they ask him, I guess rather nervously, when's this going to happen, Jesus? Will there be a sign that all this is kind of like coming to a head? And Jesus responds by saying, well, be careful. It's going to be tricky to see the signs. There will be some who will try and lead you the wrong way, and they'll be claiming to be someone they're not. And you'll hear all sorts of disturbing stuff, so you'll need to keep your head about you, and just don't panic. This is just the way things are going to go. Don't be surprised. It's the way things are. And some of the things, well, they're going to be really, really hard. But do know, this is all leading somewhere. There's an end point to this. And he goes on to describe all sorts of difficulties that will need to be faced. You know, wars and all sorts of worry about wars and persecutions. And they even tell him that they'll be taken to court and that they'll be in front of high officials like governors and kings. And remember, the disciples are pretty ordinary Joes and Janes. Most of them couldn't read or write. And the thought of standing and speaking in front of that kind of august company would be terrifying to them. But Jesus anticipated that, and he said, don't worry about what you're going to say. The Holy Spirit will give you the words, and you will actually proclaim the good news that the nations need to hear. And he goes on to say that even families will be split, and they will be hated for their association with Jesus, all because they're his disciples. So it's going to be hard, but do know, if you endure to the end, you will be saved, he says. As one trusted biblical commentator notes, Jesus is trying to prepare his disciples for both the worst and the best of what is to come. And it did come. The things described, all of them happened. Wars and persecutions, and yes, the complete destruction of the temple in 70 A.D., And yes, after the temple was destroyed, the Romans actually did pry the stones apart, looking for gold that had been melted in the fire. So no, not one stone was left upon the other. Prophecy was fulfilled. And yes, there's more. Jesus declared that these are but the birth pangs. Now, as a guy, I'm always a little tentative about going too far into discussions about birth. This be tiger country for guys who tread there. But I was at the birth of my own two children. And I've attended in different capacities a goodly number of other births in the operating room and elsewhere when I worked in the hospital. So despite the clear limits to what I know, I do know this, and it's the obvious, that birth brings life and hope. But it's also traumatic. It's also hard. It's painful. It's usually a whole bunch better after than during. And during birth, for the main participants, even including drones like me, it can get a bit desperate at times. It can seem like you're trapped and powerless. And the end, yes, that precious little baby, it can seem far, far away as you wonder if all this discomfort is actually worth it. It's just hard to endure. It's hard to endure to the end, even to a wonderful end. A few minutes ago, I admitted to being less enamored with apocalyptic films as I once was. When it seems like my world is really ending, it's somehow less entertaining. And what I mean by that is, at this age and stage, and there are some people who know this much earlier on in their lives, so it's not necessarily even an age and stage thing, I guess. But I can see how my belief that I have power, control in my life is a bit more of a lie than I've been telling myself. You ever had that realization that the world's ending? Or at least that something you thought was permanent that would just go on and on and on and on, but you suddenly realize that it actually has a lifespan, that it was transitory, that it's fleeting. You know, like you work hard, you save your money, you invest carefully for that retirement that will be filled with travel and winter, say, in Provence. I'm just thinking out loud here. And then the economy tanks and all those resources are reduced to the point where retirement becomes more of a dream, like a bad dream. And you did everything right. And it's like the world you imagined is ending. It's like there's been an earthquake and the ground beneath you, beneath your feet, has shifted completely. Or you have that fabulous relationship with Miss or Mr. Wright. And this one's a keeper. This is going to carry on until death do us part. And then death does indeed part you. Or for some reason, the relationship founders. It goes on the rocks. And you never saw this coming. And it's like your world collapses. Or you exercise and you eat right. You take supplements. You go to the doctor with regularity. You never miss a checkup. You get 8 hours of sleep every night. You do all the right things health-wise. And then there's that diagnosis that you just never saw coming, that you never expected. And this carefully planned life, if it isn't ending, it's sure a whole lot different than you'd hoped for. Or the kids you invested so much time into, they just keep making these idiotic decisions and they get deeper and deeper into trouble. Or worse, you outlive them. Or the aging and ill parents who invested so much of their lives in you are proving to be a much heavier load than expected. And there you are, stuck in between. And it seems that your life, with all those plans, seem to revolve around bouncing from one emergency to another, with the kids, with the parents. Or you belong to a church that is suddenly and quite unexpectedly stumbling into a crisis, perhaps of its own making, has gotten a bit lost. And now what do? It's always been there. It's just kind of moved in a rather unexpected and disturbing direction. And what you thought were the rules just somehow got changed. And it's as if there's been an earthquake and the ground beneath your feet has shifted completely. So when all is thrown down, what do you do? Jesus has a command that he repeats over and over and over in the Gospels. And it's, follow me. This is the definition of a Christian, one who follows Jesus. And it's far more than simple intellectual assent to whom Jesus is. You know, the great teacher, the example, the prophet, the second person of the Trinity. A disciple is a follower of Jesus, is someone who follows Jesus. That's what a Christian is. Someone who attempts, imperfectly for sure, but who attempts to walk the walk, who does, who acts, who lives in a particular way because they've been changed by that encounter with Jesus and are continuing to be changed. So, following is about action, right? It's about a way of living. But I think our passage today also suggests that there's a bit more than doing to the Christian life. For example, there's also watching. Paying attention to the signs of the times, for indeed the end is near. But which end? The preacher and teacher Darrell Johnson, right at the beginning of the book Discipleship on the Edge, which is his excellent study of the book of Revelation. He says that the message of Revelation, despite its mystical language and its otherworldly images, it's actually quite simple. It really is. It's quite simple. And here it is. Two words. This is it. This is what Revelation is all about. God wins. In the end, God wins. The end is actually God's end. And existence is moving relentlessly toward God's end. And when the world is ending, take heart, because it means that somehow God is afoot. It means that the marriage feast of the Lamb is just a little bit closer. When the world is ending, the one thing we know with absolute certainty is that Jesus is actually closer. He's near. Now, most of you know that Diane and I are a part of what's called the Crucifusion Organization of United Church Ministers, and its whole reason for being, its only reason, is to lift up Jesus' name in the United Church of Canada. It has no agenda beyond that, because in part because I rather doubt we could agree on anything else. We're a rather diverse group. And take heart. Do take heart. Diane and I are largely considered to be elders in that group. Even die. They're mostly relatively young, and they should be around the church for a good long while. And the improbable, no, I would say bizarre announcement of last week that, at least for the moment, a minister who doesn't believe in God will remain in her pulpit, well, that caused no small amount of consternation, as it seems to also to the majority of my colleagues, even those who are not part of the Crucifusion Organization. And certainly the feedback I got at our final presbytery meeting yesterday was like, what's this about? Disbelief. There was no small amount of grief and heartbreak expressed, because these are kind of difficult times. But the grief and heartbreak, in some ways, it moved very, very quickly to something rather interesting. One of our number, within hours of this announcement, she suggested we embrace one of the earliest spiritual practices of the Christian church, and we began a period of prayer and fasting, attempting to seek a word from the God who, contrary to some opinion, most certainly exists. We were reminded that God's moving this project called the church forward, and that Jesus remains on the throne. In fact, the marks of his sacrificial love, they're still there on his hands. I have not one clue as to when God's going to sound that final trumpet and bring this thing to a close. In fact, beware of anyone who says that they do have a clue. That's what Jesus was warning about in the Bible reading today. I have not one clue as to when the new heaven and earth will be a reality that removes all doubt as to God. What I do know as that even as my world might be ending, Jesus is close. He's very close. And I know that God wins. As the ancient rabbi said, all else is commentary.